Greetings, everybody. I'm going to open up the meeting for the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Transportation and Economic Development Subcommittee. It is 1 o'clock. Okay, it's 1:10 on this Tuesday, February 21st, one day after my birthday, in case anybody cared.
I survived my birthday yesterday.
Yeah. So, anyway, welcome. We do have a full agenda. Apologize for starting tardy here, so we're going to move along very quickly. And I'm going to start by opening up a work session on Senate Bill 1547A relating to captive insurance. Ms. Lamont, would you take it away for us?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1547 allows the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to authorize captive insurance insurers in Oregon and provides for their regulation. There's a fiscal impact. There's an amendment to the bill to add the expenditure limitation related to that fiscal impact.
All right. J.L. Wilson, would you like to come up and bring anybody else, or would you like to direct Gary or anybody else, whoever wants to speak to this? And while Gary is coming up, this may be the only exception today to the rule on 1547 because it is a work session. We can talk about the bill and the policy aspect of it. There aren't going to be any changes made, anything like that. And so, but from here on out, I just want to give fair warning to everybody that this is a Ways and Means Subcommittee, so we're going to be dealing with fiscal aspects today, not going to be entertaining policy issues. The assumption, and if other subcommittees aren't following the rules, I apologize. We are trying to follow the rules. We three co-chairs met with the co-chairs heading into the session. They said, you're a subcommittee. Deal with the financial aspects of the bill, assuming that the policies have been worked out prior to getting to you. So we're going to be very careful not to deal with policy issues today, assuming that those were done in other parts of the building. So having said that, identify yourselves and take it away. Thanks.
Thank you, co-chairs and members. For the record, J.L. Wilson with Associated Oregon Industries. Senate Bill 1547 is a priority of ours, but I'm going to defer here to my expert and our member, Gary Hargis.
Excuse me. I'm Gary Hargis, and I'm the proponent of Senate Bill 1547. And you've all received material from us. I'll field any questions about what the bill does. It's quite technical in some respects, and I put several committees to sleep talking about it.
So, Gary, is it possible to maybe in 2 minutes kind of tee it up to give folks in the room a little bit of idea of what you are trying to accomplish here?
Chairman, a captive insurance company is a limited licensed insurance company that insures its parent corporation. It's available in 27 other states. It is a risk management vehicle, and our intent to allow it in Oregon is so that we can bring the jobs of the managing those captives into Oregon.
Probably one of the more fascinating aspects of this, because I really didn't care to get into the weeds of the bill too terribly much, but talking about the job aspect and the economic development, I believe an example was Arizona. Do you have some of the numbers with you to give an idea of what kind of jobs or dollars it could mean for the state of Oregon?
I'll give one other example. Willamette University is part of a group that has a captive, and it's the Private Colleges of Oregon. And they banded together in an association captive, and that's where they insure their general liability. They do that because they can get a better price for that expense from the captive than they can in the marketplace. One thing that the state of Arizona did is they started their captive program about 10 years ago. They presently have about 75 captives domiciled in Arizona, and the economic impact that's been measured by various groups is approximately $11 million a year. And the benefit to the Treasury directly, I believe, if I'm quoting it correctly, is $1.5 million a year. So it's a plus.
Okay. Committee. Senator Berger.
Yes, I have a question for JL. You said it was one of your priorities, and who is we? who is
Forgive
our.
Me. Associated Oregon Industries. Thank you.
Okay. Senator Starr?
We heard this in the policy committee that I serve on. I think this is, you know, one of those opportunities to bring home to Oregon business that's going outside of our state. I can't endorse this bill any greater degree than asking that we move it as quickly as we can up the chain so we can get this business in Oregon.
Any other questions, comments? Seeing none. Thank you, gentlemen. I guess I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Legislative Fiscal Office recommends that the subcommittee approve the proposed -A2 amendment and move the bill as amended to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Reed.
Mr. Chair, I move that the subcommittee accept the LFO recommendation that the bill be moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Reed has a motion on the table to accept the LFO recommendation and move the Senate Bill 1547 up to the full Ways and Means.
As amended.
As amended. Thank you. Any comments or questions? Seeing none. Any opposition? Seeing none. So moved.
Mr. Chair, I need carriers, someone to carry it to full and then to the House and the Senate.
I'd like to carry it on the Senate floor. I can't carry it to full.
Okay, Senate floor, Senator Starr. Representative McClain.
Thank you, Mr.
You're
Chair.
You're kind of at the end there, and it just doesn't roll down any further from that. Did I hear a volunteer?
Did I hear? Thank you.
All right.
That's cold.
Thank you so much.
Mr. Chair, to be the coordinating member with Senator Starr is quite prestigious for me, so I would delight Nick.
Careful.
Okay, thank you very much. We have our carriers. We'd like to remind everybody that there is overflow in HR 170 next door, that direction, right? So overflow in HR 170. So if we're full in here, please go to 170 so the fire marshal doesn't shut us down. Let's see. Okay, got that bit of housekeeping. And so now I am going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 4040A. I didn't close the work session, Patty. I could have swore I did. I am going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1547A and open up a public hearing on House Bill 4040-A relating to investment for economic development. And while Representative Co-Chair Reed takes the dais, I'm going to ask Mr. Bender to kind of tee us up here.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. House Bill 4040 comes to you without dissenting votes from the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. The bill establishes the Oregon Growth Fund and the Oregon Growth Board to coordinate investment in economic development in the state of Oregon. There are a number of provisions of this bill, primarily the bill. Most of these provisions will not become active absent a reaffirmation of them in the 2013 legislative session. I do note for you that there are a set of amendments that were distributed in the packet along with the bill, the -12 amendments that proponents have developed to address some constitutional problems with the bill as it came to you in the Angros version.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bender. Representative Reed, do you and Michael want to take it away and talk about the bill a little bit, but in particular the amendments that were necessary to get folks on board? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm Tobias Reed, State Representative from District 27. I appreciate particularly the way you began our meeting today by distinguishing between policy and fiscal matters. And I think that's appropriate, particularly in the case of the Oregon Investment Act, House Bill 4040 before us now, because the fiscal elements of this bill are quite limited. This is very much a policy bill, and the amendments that we hope will be adopted are merely of a clarifying nature, are technical, and do not change the policy intent, I think, in any way. I'd like to take just a very quick minute to give you a quick history of the bill, Many of you already know it. And then the expert, Michael Salvaggio, can help us talk about the technical nature of the amendments. This bill came as a result of a conversation that began between Governor Kitzhaber's election and his inauguration, when several of us traveled around the state asking business leaders, entrepreneurs, community leaders, what they felt was missing or what was holding them up from expanding their businesses and hiring people. And in general, what we found was access to capital was a big problem, that our economic development efforts in the state are generally some cases scattered amongst different agencies, so we don't always know about all the opportunities that exist, and sometimes when we do know about them, there are sideboards that are that prevent capital and resources from connecting with good opportunities. So this bill is intended to make our economic development efforts smarter and more effective and more accountable. A much better effort at coordination, much more flexibility, and more effectiveness on leverage, bringing additional private sector capital to Oregon and deploying it in the right places. The largest part of what I think this bill is going to do is begin the conversation. This creates the Oregon Growth Board. All that policy is in the bill that will come back to the legislature with recommendations for additional policy changes and likely seeking this committee and this legislature's approval for dollars to be managed in a much more comprehensive and connected, coordinated way. There's plenty more of that policy, but again, because we're focused on the fiscal matters here, I think I'll stop there and let Michael describe the technical nature of the amendments that clarify some of the contents of the bill. Thank you, Mr.
Fisher. Thank you, Michael.
Representative Huffman, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Salvaggio from the Office of the State Treasurer. To jump into this where the representative left off, the Dash A-12 amendments, as LFO staff mentioned, addressed a difficulty in incorporating Education Stability Fund dollars in the form of the Oregon Growth Account. What the 12s do in sum is create a more explicit distinction between dollars that are in the growth fund from the Education Stability Fund. Actually, I'm going to wheel it back because to create a distinction between dollars that the Growth Board has authority over that were from the Education Stability Fund versus dollars that they have authority over that did not come from the Education Stability Fund because of that constitutional overlay. The other changes that were made in the recent few amendments involve how several sections come into play and drop out of play depending on how the next legislative session goes with regards to approving the board's strategy and work plan. The board itself comes into being upon passage and the governor's approval of this bill. What does not become active immediately are the board's financial powers, the creation of the fund, the Oregon Growth Account being given over to the authority of the board. These will only take effect at soonest January 2014, and in that case only if the 2013 legislature approves the board's recommendations. If the legislature does not approve those recommendations, then those particular sections will be repealed at the end of the current biennium or at the end of June 2013. If that happens, and we don't expect it to, but if it does, then the board will have one last-ditch effort to appeal to the 2014 legislative session with a revised plan. And if the legislature fails to act in that case, then the board itself evaporates at the end of the June 2014. So what we have here is a bill that takes effect in stages and only in the event that the legislature approves its plan moving forward.
it's going to be very difficult to live by my own rules because, you know, the only questions I can really think of are policy, and I know that they were surely gotten on the record in the policy committee. You know, I'd jump out with a question about why are we doing something like this? What did you find out in the roadshow? Why are we doing it instead of the private sector doing it? What vacancy are we trying to fill? But I think that gets into the policy, and it would be inappropriate. So I will stand down on that. Any questions? Speaking of fiscal, we're not working the bill today. It's public hearing only. So are we waiting on a fiscal, or do you know the status of that?
Mr. Co-Chair, I would humbly suggest and request that when the public hearing is held over today, that we might be able to, or is completed, we might be able to carry over the bill even to the end of today. I think there's still some discussion ongoing.
Senator Johnson.
I want to try to stay within your sideboards of fiscal only, and I draw on my experience along with Representative Reed on our service on the Oregon Business Development Department. There has been a lot of discussion about sideboards in contracting documents. I think for some of the advocates that have lobbied me about this bill, they have talked about the possibility of infusions of capital. And I would like you, if you would, to comment on some of the protections that are built into this bill, if there are extensions of capital that would give people assurance that fiscal relationships between the state and the beneficiary companies are responsible, are prudent, and protect the state's fiscal interests.
Thank you for the question, Mr. Co-Chair.
Did I color inside the lines?
I think so.
Okay. Senator Johnson, I think it's an entirely appropriate question, and I'll happily have Michael fill any details that I miss. I think the first place to start is the makeup of the board, which is very specific as to professional experience and expertise. We're also very clear in setting up the sequence that's envisioned in this bill, that the growth board will come back to the legislature for additional scrutiny before anything additional takes place. So we'll all have a chance to weigh in again with specific recommendations. But it does speak to the things that I think you and I have both seen to identify those gaps. We want to make sure that whatever we do, because voters have told us to be engaged in economic development, that it's as effective and efficient and smart as possible. And among those things are making sure that the decisions are led by the private sector. I don't think any of us who've been involved with the bill envision the state being a lead or sole investor or participant in extensions of credit or those sorts of things, but rather to fill a gap that might be critical to getting a business off the ground or to expanding. So I think it starts with specific expertise. It works through the legislative process, and the pieces that we'll hopefully be back with as part of a smart plan will include all sorts of safeguards that you and I might imagine.
Thank you.
And if, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could continue along those lines of thought, Section 6 of the bill actually does require the board to act through intermediaries, either as a limited partner in making investments or as a member in a fund of funds or through a private sector manager. So that there's no direct investments being made by the board, which provides a layer of, for one, political insulation, but also in requiring these private sector managers to come with a certain amount of leverage, we have the protection of requiring skin in the game, so to speak, which adds another layer of vetting these investments. So it would be... The intent of the bill, and I think the way we've written it, precludes this board from either coming into investment directly on their own without any kind of participation from someone else who's some other investor who's also taken a look at that and deemed it a good investment.
Senator Berger.
Yes. I wonder if you might just simplistically follow the money for me. You have a fund, you have a board, and this money is going to go out, and it's going to be partnered and leveraged. Explain to me exactly how that works. The board oversees the fund. Does the board make the decision about the money?
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, let me start with a flip response and then a bit more serious one. The short answer is maybe. And I say that because remember that the board, if this bill passes, will come back with a specific recommendation. But what has motivated us to take this approach is the fact that there are lots of different ways that the state might play a role in filling a gap. For example, we've heard elsewhere in the legislature, and I think the bill is headed to the Senate now, about the credit enhancement fund that the Business Development Department operates. That's a loan guarantee program that works very well. That might be a component of what the board comes back with as recommendations. They might recommend that we put more money in that channel. There might be a mechanism to allow for foundations in Oregon to invest in a fund that has economic development in Oregon as a primary goal. That might be among the recommendations. So there are a lot of different possibilities, and what we're trying to do with this legislation is be specific enough so that legislators can understand it, including me certainly, but also intentionally flexible enough that we're not unintentionally precluding some smart strategy. But in every case, actual decisions would be made by professional managers, not by the board. The board would allocate amongst different channels and be able to respond more quickly than we often can in the legislature. Hopefully, credit markets are going to improve so that the credit enhancement fund plays a less critical role and the private sector will have more credit flowing. And so the board might recommend that in sometime in the future is less critical and that those dollars might go to a more effective channel. I hope that makes sense. I'm happy to
follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So is it fair to say that the investment is going to really be based on an individual one at a time? Kind of investment. There may be a number of rules that you'll be following, but the actual investment of the money or how it's set up will be each individual investment would be different.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I'm not sure. I'm a little uncomfortable answering that in a yes or no, because I think I might not be understanding exactly what you mean by individual investment. I think the board the legislature could decide based on the recommendation of the whole plan that the board comes back with to say we're going to give the board X number of dollars. And the board might then say, we're going to allocate those dollars amongst these channels, X, subset of X to the credit enhancement fund, subset of X to a variety of other things. And each of those things would be managed by professional managers, by fund managers, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that makes sense. Then they might come back in a future legislature and ask for a different amount of dollars and have a different allocation strategy. That's going to hopefully change over time in response mm-hmm. to the market and where those gaps are. Does that help?
Mm-hmm. It does. That clarifies it. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Mr.
Representative, it was probably answered sufficiently. Just a quick question on the Dash A-12. The original part of the bill had gotten some $20 million of bonding, I believe it was, included in that, and the Dash A-12 removes that.
Yes.
So we're not looking at starting this fund with state-borrowed money and right out of the gate. And
Mr. Chair, that is not in the A-12s.
Okay. All righty. Senator Starr?
Just real curious where the money's coming from. Is this, you're just changing the name of this account, creating some new policies, processes, but the money that was flown into the old growth account is basically the same money that's flown into the new account. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, Michael can correct me here, but that is the intention. However, it does not activate until the next legislature would approve that. We're hopeful, of course, that this board will be able to ascertain an allocation strategy and a plan that receives sufficient support from the legislature that we would be able to appropriate new dollars to that purpose, but that's not in this bill.
And, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to put a slightly sharper point on that, this is really the crux of the A-12 amendments in that LFO rightfully pointed out that to make the growth account be a portion of the growth fund would actually be, in a legal sense, moving it out of the Education Stability Fund, which has a locked fund we weren't able to do. So without having much practical effect on how these monies would be put to use, the growth account itself remains intact no matter what happens moving forward. There's nothing in this bill that anticipates the growth account itself being changed or renamed or subsumed anymore under the -12s. What does happen is that the board that once handled the management of that money will go away. And that management responsibility, but not the location of the funds, will transfer to the new board.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Anything else from the dais? Senator Johnson.
I guess long term, my understanding of this bill would be that in its full flower, it would create a mechanism to consolidate all of the disparate economic development grant-making functions that are now undertaken by lots of agencies in small amounts. Is that a correct assumption?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I think it's very much the intent to at least be intentional about that. I want to be careful about that in that there are, I think we are, part of the reason that I believe this bill is needed is that we don't have a good understanding of all of those and how they interact. There might well be reasons that some should not be part of this group, but we want to at the very least be intentional about that and decide deliberately.
I very much appreciate your use of the word intentional. It has been my observation watching the proliferation of earmarked accounts that we are causing the projects to follow the money rather than good projects coming to the surface where there might be a role for state investment and then with adequate and professional scrutiny cause there to be a state participation in those. I would look for a day when that is the norm and we stop carving out, you know, for this little series of activities a de minimis amount of money that doesn't really make any difference for this particular class of folks, you know, ports having money held aside with not the rigor or the accountability until just recently. So that's one of my enthusiasms for this bill is that intentional and deliberate focused investment rather than just this disparate sort of, a friend of mine refers to it as beat to fit, paint to match, that you can make any project fit some silo somewhere, but that this would be have much more rigor and discipline.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I can't speak for all the other 40-some co-sponsors, but I think you and I are exactly on the same page as far as that goes.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to call up John Charles. Good afternoon. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Charles, president of Cascade Policy Institute, a nonprofit policy research organization. And I'll follow your guidelines today by trying and limit my remarks to basically one topic, which has to do with what would be the long-term fiscal effects of creating this, what has a lot to do with the incentive structure for how money is managed and the accountability for how decisions get made. And the comment was made earlier today and also in prior hearings about the skin in the game problem. A lot of skin in the game tends to get people's attention before they make decisions. And I think this bill attempts to do that, but ultimately it's not there. And so there's a large risk that over time the fiscal impacts will be large. And I'll just do a brief comparison, contrast, and then stop to make my point. My view of what skin in the game would be, for instance, looking back on the AOL-Time Warner merger of 11 years ago, widely considered one of the worst business disasters in history, Ted Turner was interviewed by New York Times a year ago and said, well, I lost $8 billion. 80% of my worth and I lost my job. I would call that major skin in the game, significant accountability. More recently, Hewlett-Packard introduced a touchpad as an ostensible competitor to the iPad. After 7 weeks, it was pulled from the market. HP later announced they were going to write down $3.3 billion of losses, and the CEO was fired. I'd say that's major skin in the game, significant accountability. More recently here, the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission released a report last month, and they advise you that the small-scale energy loan program, because of a number of bad decisions in the last 3 years, is going to have has about $20 million of losses, and your general fund will have to make up the $20 million in increments between 2015 and 2020. And when the head of Department of Energy was interviewed by the Oregonian last month about this, he said, well, it was caused by the credit crunch. It's really not our fault, and no one's going to lose their job over this. If that was accurate, then I'd say there was no skin in the game and very little accountability. That's the problem with these fake venture capital funds that you keep creating. You can try and get skin in the game. You can try and create accountability. But it's never going to be the same situation as real venture capital funds have in the real economy. I don't think the problem is solvable. And if you go forward with this, you will start spending a small amount of money now. But we know how that goes. It'll be bigger and bigger, and you won't be able to solve the problem later. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions of Mr. Charles? Thank you. I always appreciate your testimony.
Thank you,
thanks,
sir,
for bringing the train down. John, or John Mollis, is he in the room nearby? Okay, John, come on over. And while you're coming over, JL, do you want to come down at the same time? Is there room for both of you? Is there headroom there? JL was too busy getting to the chair. He didn't get. John, why don't you kick it off, take it away.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Huffman, members of the committee. John Mollis representing the Oregon Building Trades Council, and I'm going to try and stay within the boundaries that you've laid out this morning or this afternoon and just say that our council wants to go on record in support. We believe this coordination will help create long-term physical benefits for the state by putting people back to work. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Huffman and members. For the record, I also want to put on the record that Associated Oregon Industries supports House Bill 4040, want to see you move it up the ladder. The reality is, from our perspective, we're competing with 49 other states for job creation, for industry, for business startups, for relocation here in the state. And to the extent that 4040 helps consolidate our tools, maximize the effectiveness of our tools, we think it's a good thing. And so we support the bill and appreciate your support.
Questions of these gentlemen? Seeing none. Thank you very much. That is everybody that was on our list. I think John Charles made some
tax fairness, I think.
While you're coming up, go right ahead, and we'll get you on the list here. You know, I think we've all seen time after time, several of us sit on a work group that over the years had spent several tens of millions of dollars, I think arguably without a lot to show for it, and there is an individual no longer in that position, but certainly not without their PERS. So you kind of have to wonder sometimes, is there any, probably no skin in the game, because like I and several of us here that have invested in our own businesses, we know what it's like to lose money, our money, nobody else's money. And that's hard to replicate out of state coffers. It's hard to replicate that skin in the game. And oftentimes we don't see even job losses from bad decisions. I'll leave it at that. But go right ahead, Jody.
Jody Weiser with Tax Fairness Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to talk. And I didn't hear your guidelines at the beginning because I was in conference with a legislator. So
we are sticking to the fiscal aspects of the bill as closely as we possibly can.
So I think my concerns are to them, but off to the side a bit. For instance, the bill talks about the funds are all being managed by someone else. But in our picture of what this is, we're going to have all the loan funds in the state under this umbrella, too. And there's nothing in the language of the bill that reflects that. And I would hope we're not going to outsource all the loan decisions, because we've been doing those in-house or with help when we felt like we needed it. But the language of the bill seems to say that it seems to be thinking only of the Oregon Growth Account and not all the other eggs we're trying to bring into the basket. And that might help right now keep the fiscal, you know, might diminish the fiscal right now, and that might make sense because it might be part of the design that the committee would come back with next session. It does seem to be kind of missing. And
Senator Johnson, do you have a
give us an example of the kind of loan programs that you're talking about?
Oh, we have, well, Business Oregon, for instance, has loan programs where they guarantee loans or they make direct loans. That we have the Department of Energy has a small energy loan program, and they allocate those funds. They make the decisions about that. And if we're bringing all of our economic development together, then this bill seems to leave that piece of the vision
okay, thank
out.
Thank you. I just wanted to understand what you were talking about.
Yeah. And the other thing that concerns me is that we have in recent years spent up to $1 million on a permanent job. There were construction jobs as well, of course, but the permanent jobs for Allen Wind Farms, we were spending $1 million each. And in three different places in the bill, sections 20, 23, and 25, they talk about what an emerging growth business is, and it's going to create significant high-skill, high-wage jobs, but there's no definition of significant or high-wage. And in this state, many of our programs, high wage is anything above the middle, which is about $33,000 a year. And most of us, if our kids came home and say they just got a $33,000 a year job, we wouldn't think it was a high wage job unless they were really young at that point. But that's kind of where the line is. And so it seems to me, if we want this to raise the per capita income in our state, we need to make sure that what we're doing is addressed in this bill, that we're aiming high needs to be, we need to have some rules around that. And so it'd be good to expect the committee to come back with those kind of definitions as well.
Thank you, Jody. Representative Reed, did you want to take a minute to comment?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, as usual, Jody brings a wealth of comments, some of them well-founded. I appreciate the notion that there are definitions to be worked out. That's, in fact, the point of the bill. And certainly high wage, I think we're talking about limited resources that go to economic development, and we want to prioritize those that create the highest wages, that create the most competitive the jobs and opportunities that are most based on competitive advantage and have the best long-run potential for the state. So I think we're on the same page on a lot of these things. And again, to just reiterate, the board is envisioned to be making allocation types of decisions, not individual decisions about loans or other kinds of participation. And it may well be that the board comes back and says the credit enhancement fund, to pick up that same example again, the administration of it should stay with business development, but that the board would recommend more or less dollars go to that channel. So I don't think we're necessarily, certainly not in this bill, proposing changes in the administration of specific programs, but rather a holistic look and smarter allocations amongst different programs.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative McClain.
Could I just ask, could we take a time out real quick?
Certainly. We're going to be in recess for a moment. the record, and if there are no additional comments or questions or thoughts regarding House Bill 4040 with the dash A12 amendments, Jody, everybody, thank you for your testimony. We're going to, there's no need to carry this over, is that?
Mr. Chair, if we are retaining the ability to have that on as a work session at our next meeting, I can live with that.
Is it proper just to go ahead and close the public hearing then?
Yes.
At this point? Okay. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 4040. And thank you, Mr. Bender. And we're going to transition. Is Robin around?
Robin, I'm sure, is here.
There she is. Okay. Okay, we're going to open up a public hearing only on Senate Bill 1543A relating to transportation. Robin?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the bill directs the Oregon Transportation Commission to report annually to the legislative committees on transportation regarding funding available for transportation projects.
Okay, first on the list.
Mr. Chair?
Sir.
Can I,
Senator Stark,
talk a little bit about this, and then
you want to open us up? That'd be great.
Would that be okay?
From here or there, either one. You go right
I'm
ahead.
I'm fine. I'm fine from here, if that's okay. So, again, this is a bill that came through the Senate Transportation Economic Development Committee that I have the opportunity to sit on. This bill, the crux of the bill, really deals with the Jobs and Transportation Act that was passed in 2009. It was House Bill 2001. I think most of us had the opportunity to vote for that bill. In that bill was Section 64 that specifically identified a list of projects, transportation projects, with a specific dollar amount. What this bill does is it contemplates moving dollars from certain projects that have been bid, and the bids have come in under the amount of money that was listed in the bill. So, for instance, there are two projects that are identified in Senate Bill 1543. It's the projects. The one is on the I-5 205, which is the auxiliary lane project. The other project is the Highway 26 widening project. Those two projects, the bids came in below the dollar amount that was listed in the bill. Because those dollar amounts were listed statutorily in the bill, we need to change statute, or we need to have a legislative action to basically reallocate or move those dollars to other transportation projects. That's what that's what's contemplated in the main part of this bill. What the Senate committee did is identify other projects that were already listed in House Bill 2001. So we didn't go out into the universe of new projects, but we stuck with the ones that were negotiated in the legislative session in 2009, which is a fund negotiation. But it identified projects, and there were projects that are in basically the same region, again, because that negotiation was a process of balancing the needs around the state. The dollars that we moved will go to projects where those dollars can be put to use right away. So we're not, again, kind of putting money on the table and just leaving it there for 24 months or 36 months, but we can actually take those dollars and put them right into a project, get Oregonians to work in this upcoming construction season. The dollars from I-5-205 move from that project to project basically just down I-205 to a project at the 257 interchange at I-84, the Troutdale interchange. The rough numbers, these numbers will have to be finalized at some later point, but the rough numbers are about $3 million are available to move from I-205, 405, mm-hmm. or I-5-205 up to 257. Again, and the rough numbers on 26 are about $4 million. And as those projects get completed, those numbers will be finalized in the bill. We didn't list the numbers or the specific dollar amount, but whatever is basically left on the table, the commission then can move to these other projects. That's the base of the bill. That's the purpose, the primary purpose of the bill. And that's, I think, what I basically wanted to get on the record. There's also a piece in here dealing with Coos Bay, Yaquina Bay, that folks can talk about if you want to hear that testimony. And then, Mr. Chair, in the policy committee, quite honestly, there's pressure to fund a very important project in Multnomah County and in the city of Portland, and that's the Selwood Bridge project. And as part of a compromise, I committed to the folks from Multnomah County, and basically the policy committee in the Senate agreed that we would work to identify dollars to fund the gap on the Selwood Bridge. And to that end, I've got a dash A-19 amendment that will fund the Selwood Bridge and basically uphold the commitment that I believe the Senate Policy Committee made to the folks from Multnomah County to fund the Selwood Bridge gap. It's $5 million. So just also an FYI, I just got these amendments back from Council just as I was sitting down here. These amendments are kind of hot off the press. I'd like to provide them to the committee so that you have them. Staff hasn't seen them yet, but you know, that's how this short session and quick timelines are. So with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'd like to provide those copies to the committee.
That would be great. Thank you.
With that, that's...
We will not entertain them today, but I appreciate you providing them.
Yeah, everyone will have the opportunity to have a look at them, but I understand the entertainment value.
I do have a question based on what you said, and you said you weren't putting hard numbers into these projects that were already identified in 2001, but so does that mean that if there are cost overruns on the I-5205, that there would not be money then that could be transferable? Is that the assumption?
So the
we're not committing to something then we wouldn't have money for?
That's correct. In the event that some unforeseen circumstance were to occur, and I think it would be unforeseen because I think if you can ask the folks from the department, but at this point they're fairly certain that there's money basically sitting there available to use, and if there were some unforeseen circumstance, we're not committing dollars we don't have to these other projects.
Okay, great. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Starr, I wonder if you could help me understand how the A-19 interacts with the amended bill.
Certainly.
And how, if the money that is dedicated to the Selwood Bridge comes from that same pool of unallocated, or where it comes from?
So, and staff may be better at explaining exactly this process, but the dollars that are identified, the dollars that will fund the Selwood Bridge, and also in the A-19s, the Cornelius Pass Road improvements, will come from the e-portal convenience fee that the department has negotiated with NIC USA in order to provide access to the DMV records. So the department has negotiated a deal basically that says these driver records are worth a certain amount, and NIC USA, in order to have access to those and create a funding stream so that they can rebuild Oregon's e-portal, basically is increasing the highway fund by a certain amount. And we're just suggesting that it would make sense to use that increase to fund the Selwood Bridge. Also, you're going to hear about another bill on our list, the rust areas, the Cornelius Pass, and also a DMV computer upgrade. So those are the short list of items that will be funded. It's out of that negotiated deal that the department has made with NIC USA, with the Department of Administrative Services, this kind of unholy alliance that is allowing the significant and serious upgrade of Oregon's e-portal, our website.
Thank you.
If it's okay, since we've started down this road, I'm going to kind of jump around here and invite Director Garrett and Paul, did you want to come up too? Okay. Come on up. And since we've started down this road, let's go ahead and hear testimony surrounding the dollars of what we've heard about, brought up by Senator Starr. And Director, go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and belated happy birthday. I'm Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. With me is Paul Mather, my Highway Division Administrator. So to Mr. Starr's statement, yeah, we have identified one project that's completed in the Section 64. That is the I-5-205 auxiliary lane. If my memory serves me correctly, imprinted in the Jobs and Transportation Act, Section 64, that project was listed as an $11 million project. Again, it is completed. It came in at $8 million.
And working very well, I might it's, add.
Yeah, not good. Absolutely. So we know we have $3 million in hand just because of the delta. As you look to Washington County, the activities that are playing themselves out on the Cornelius to 185th project, we think we're going to realize savings. We can't tell you how much because that project does not complete until the end of this construction season. But that said, soft numbers right now, what we believe that'll be somewhere between four, maybe a little less, but we won't know exactly how much until that project is completed and we get third note and we know we don't have anything else to pay out. So,
okay. Any questions up at this point for the director? Paul?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator. I just want to go over kind of the nuts and bolts. Senator Starr did a nice job kind of walking through a lot of what I was going to talk about. But just, again, a reminder that the projects that are listed in Section 64 of the Jobs and Transportation Act are specific projects with specific limits and dollar amounts that if we had changed those, we need legislation to change those. What this bill does is ask our commission each November to come forward with a list of savings and then a list of projects or recommendations that they would recommend to legislature to fund. And then the two specific projects that were talked about, the 185th, the 257th interchange, that's a Troutdale interchange, and 84 is one of the projects where the additional money would go to. That's, again, already identified as a Jobs and Transportation Act, already in the bill. It is set for just construction in 2013. The other project that was talked about is the Chute Road Interchange or the Brookwood Interchange project. That's also scheduled for construction to start in 2013.
All righty. Questions? Seeing none. Gentlemen, thank you.
Okay.
While you're here, comment? We can segue into the other part of the bill, some of the other amendments. I kind of got lost in the dashes, and Senator Starr, you can join in here too, but dash 8s. 15s, 16s, whatever.
I think, Mr. Chairman, we have not seen the dash 19s. I believe it. We have not seen those, so we've heard about them, but we haven't seen them.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Starr.
While I was sitting here, I emailed them to Director Garrett, so they're on his BlackBerry, but it's probably hard to read. But they are similar to the amendments that the director and I have talked about, so it should be familiar, at least somewhat familiar with them.
Okay.
So, not to lead with my chin, but to share, and I'm sure the good senator will correct me if I go off the pathway, but to speak to what I understand. Senator Starr did a very good job of articulating a funding source that was identified in terms of this this fee specific to the driver and motor vehicles records. Generates roughly about $7.9 million a year if indeed the levels of request are maintained as we move in a potential direction here. So the money is new. Conversations as to where this money may be directed, they're all appropriate uses. There's no question. This is an asset of the trust fund. All these uses, all these projects identified are appropriate uses. There may be more. I'd be remiss. We've had conversations. The good senator mentioned the DMV computer system. Sure, there are other issues. We've come before this subcommittee to say there are facilities, DMV facilities. So there's a host of issues. But everything articulated, as I understand it, is an appropriate use of that fund. I would be remiss that there is somewhat of a specter out there in terms of some folks that do not believe there is the authority to move in the direction to generate this money or a convenience fee to pay the vendor who would create this enhanced portal into government here. Again, that's the legal saber has been shaken. There's no question about it. And that's just to the extent that may potentially bring an issue that we will have to face in terms of longer-term revenue flows, depending on if indeed it is litigated and depending on the outcome of the litigation, what the impacts are. Those are longer-term issues that are before us here. I just thought it important that that I share that just because I've been privy to those conversations. So.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen. Is Dugan in the room? Dugan, there you are, Becky. Would you mind coming up, and now that the discussion of ePortal has been broached, if you could share with the committee, sorry if this is disjointed, but if once you get into 1543, you see that there are a couple of different aspects to the bill. So Mr. Petty gave a good presentation of ePortal yesterday afternoon to the Audits and IT Committee, and so I think it's a good idea for now that we're into that and talking about this potential $8 million pot of money, if you could, and we are running a little short on time, if you could kind of tee up what ePortal is and where this $8 million would come from.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dugan Petty. I'm the state's chief information officer for the Department of Administrative Services. We're passing out a document that might kind of simplify this and make it helpful.
Thank you.
Currently, if you look at the top band of this document, it shows where the current funding is for driving records. Driving records are purchased by seven disseminators from the Department of Motor Vehicle, and they charge $2 per driving record. And that results in $3.6 million that is used by DMV for their cost of their operations. We currently have a contract expiring that supports the e-government portal. It expires on June 30th, and we have been working since 2009 to replace that. We've gone through an RFP process, we've awarded a contract, and we are in the middle of transforming that e-government system right now, and we'll be transitioning to the new portal on 6/30 of 2006. If you look down below, this breaks out in this the pie chart, the new funding model. And at the top, you see the $2 fee for the Department of Motor Vehicles.
You want to backtrack on the year?
Yes.
Instead of 2006, did you mean?
Oh, I'm sorry. 16? Yes, I meant 2012.
Okay. I thought I
June, heard. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, June 30, 2012.
Thank you.
The new funding model involves the $2 for DMV. It involves a $3 portal fee, which will operate the new portal that NICUSA will collect off of this self-funding model. And it also includes a $4.68 fair value fee that's collected and goes to the highway fund. And that's based upon what fair value is to purchase this license right from the Department of Transportation, DMV, for the Department of Administrative Services to set up and run the portal. That results in an additional at 1.8 million records per year. At that amount, an additional 8.4 million that would come to the highway fund that's not realized at this point. NICUSA collects the $3, operates the portal, gives us enhanced and improved portal services across state government. And so that's the way the self-funding model works.
Okay. Senator Johnson.
I just want to get it clear on the record, Dugan. Nothing in this, in the bill, would do any damage to ePortal. Everything stays just the same. This is just the delta between the cost and what's it being paid for it.
As I understand it, I have not seen the amendment, Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, that 468 is the delta. It's new money to the highway fund. And as I understand from what I've heard this afternoon, that's apparently the funds that would be used to fund these projects. And that would go to the highway fund. That'll be collected on a per transaction basis, and that's for the department and for you to decide how you should use it. The $3 that's collected by NICUSA funds the cost of the portal operation. And then DMV continues to get their $2. This allows us to bring down the cost to agencies for the e-government program and puts it on a sustainable basis.
Dugan, the current system that has been HP-based and whatnot, DMV or the records we're talking about here, that's not the only agency or entity that has used the e-portal.
That's correct.
For business. Is that correct? So are there possibly other opportunities out there that could maybe generate a little bit of money in other areas?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, there are. A good example is the state of Utah. When they began their e-portal operations a number of years back, they were 100% funded from driving records. Now they're about 40% funded from driving records because they found other value-add transactions where it makes sense for businesses to get the information electronically, and so it's a win for the business and it's a win for the state. This model is now used. I understand today Maryland executed a contract with NICUSA in 26 other states. So the funding model has been very successful to deliver effective portal operations.
Is this change in the funding model, do you view it as more fair in that the user or end user will actually be paying the fee instead of possible general fund going into an agency and then that money being siphoned off into use of the e-portal, or how do you view the following the dollars?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess one way to look at fairness is from the sense of what the costs are that disseminators currently collect in the state or pay in the state. Oregon right now is at $2 per driving record. That is among the lowest charges for driving records across the 50 states. It ranges up to $27.50 in Oklahoma, and the national average is $3.50-something, I believe, in self-funded states, and $8.36 or $8.50 in states that across all the states. So right now, the disseminators who aggregate these records are getting a pretty good deal on the price that they pay in Oregon. And this 968 is pretty close to where the national average is for what these records cost.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Petty before we move on? And I apologize for the rapid pace. Thank you, Dugan.
Thank
Appreciate
you,
it. Don, are you still in the room and want to testify? Is it Odermott?
So, yeah, he's here to answer questions primarily if there's questions about the Chute Road Interchange Project. If there's no questions.
And I assume we don't have any. Is that correct? Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, we are going to shift gears yet again, and we are going to move into the final. I thought Patty almost had a heart attack there when she heard me. We're going to move into the final aspect of the bill, or one of the final aspects, and that's the Port of Coos Bay portion of the bill, which came in at least in Dash 15s and maybe others, but anyway. So Dave Fiskum, sir, would you like to come up? And is there anybody else that didn't get on the sheet to testify on Senate Bill 1543 that wanted to be? Okay, we have somebody, Patty. If Dave, did you have anybody else to come up and be with you? Okay, go right ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair, committee members, chairs, committee members, good afternoon. For the record, Dave Fiskum here, representing the Coos Bay and Yaquina Bay Pilot Association, the Coos Bay Towboat Company, and the Columbia River Pilots. Frankly, committee members, it may end up being a little difficult for me to hew to the bright line the chairs have set to allow comments only on fiscal aspects of this bill and not on policy aspects. I will try to do so to the best of my ability. This has been a difficult issue for my clients to face for three weeks now. I would like to thank the co-chairs of this committee for tolerating my appearances in their office over the last 48 hours, as well as the chair of the Senate Business and Transportation Committee, in which Senator Starr sits, for tolerating my representation of my clients on this issue. What I would tell you is that it will be very important for you, I submit, from the standpoint of the fiscal impact, to pay attention to the fiscal impact statement when it arrives. I have checked in the last few minutes on the website, and it is not there yet, and that will come to you from the Board of Maritime Pilots, as well as the place where the Board of Maritime Pilots is, in fact, housed, the Public Utility Commission. I do not know what that fiscal will be. It may not be large. I guess I would submit to you, and I think this may get close to the line, Mr. Chair, so I'll look for your gavel to hit me in the head or on the dais there. But I would submit to you that I think my clients believe there is also a fiscal impact on the Coos Bay in Yaquina Bay Bar and Harbor from the Section 5, page 4, I believe, of the Ingalls bill. Section 5 is the operative language that, when it was inserted in the Senate Business Committee, was to a degree the -15 amendments. Mr. Chair, you mentioned that number. I believe in the end the -15s and the then -8s in committee were inserted to the bill as the -16s. They're in the bill. Section 5 is the operative section. And I would encourage you to pay some attention to that. Your chair, Mr. Chair, you've been very kind to allow me to suggest to me that you would allow documents I have submitted to you over the last days to be put on the record in this committee. And I won't repeat those to you now, but we'll rely on you to do that with the staff. I would tell you that the
Actually, Mr. Fiskin, if you have the documents and you want to, you know, read the title of those into the records and then make sure they're made available, that's great.
I will do so from memory. There are two letters from Kevin Davis, the legal counsel for the Pilot Association and the towboat company I represent. There is also a letter from the Columbia River Pilots, my other client in this, that raises questions about the Section 5 of Senate Bill, the Ingalls version of Senate Bill 1543. There are letters from ILWU individuals in Coos Bay, including the Pensioners Association. I have submitted those, will submit those for the record. There was a letter from Mrs. Curtis Soss from Coos Bay, who raised questions about testimony at the first hearing, I believe on February 7th in the Senate Business Committee. I provided that for the record. And then I've also provided for the record the -14 amendments, which were not adopted in committee, which were my client's attempts to suggest that this was an issue that would be well handled by the State Board of Maritime Pilots. And in its wisdom, as Senator Starr knows, the committee in which he serves did not choose to accept those, but I did provide those to you for the record as an indication of the seriousness with which my clients have dealt with this issue as it's been before this legislature for a couple of weeks now. Those are the documents I would encourage you to read. I think the difficulty of this short session process, just one last point, Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, is to simply say that the effect of this process will mean that there has not been a review by a House Policy Committee of this issue, to which I say, so be it. I understand that. I don't argue with that. It's with that in mind that I think it's important for especially members of the House, if not others, to read the documents I've submitted for the record. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions or correct the record if I've said something inaccurately. Thank you.
Any questions, Mr. Fiskum? Senator Berger.
Thank you. Mr. Fiskum, did you say that we should have a letter in our file from the Columbia River Pilots?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, yes, I did. I have submitted that to you in the past. I will make sure that is submitted again. Right. By the
I would appreciate that. I do not have it, and is it my understanding that they're not involved in the bill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, is it permissible to you, Mr. Chair, if I answer that question?
Yes.
Originally, the dash either 4 or 6 amendments, and somebody behind me can correct the number, but included 4, I believe.
Yes, 4.
Included a reference to the Columbia River and the Columbia River Bar. In a later set of amendments by the proponents of this issue, the Columbia River and Bar were excluded from those amendments, but my client, the Columbia River Pilots, believe that there is still an implication for those 39 pilots of Senate Bill 1543-A in the sense that A river pilot, one of the 39, is Captain Steve Woods, who had hoped to be here today but is not here because I can talk about the fiscal impact as well as he can, I believe. He is the dispatched from Portland backup pilot to the only pilot who lives in Coos Bay. The only bar pilot lives in Coos Bay. So the river pilots are still raising questions for what their questions are worth and did so in the Senate committee about what became Section 5 of the bill. That's what the letter says. That's the letter, Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, I will provide to your staff by the end of the day.
I'd be happy to see that, Mr. Chairman, just for the record. I believe that Captain Woods has a residence in Coos Bay.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, that is exactly right. As you know better than I, Senator, Captain Woods, Steve Woods, used to live there, and so he's very familiar to you, I know, and others in Coos Bay. So you're right about that, where he does own a residence. Thank you.
Okay, seeing no other questions or comments, Dave, thank you very much for coming today. Appreciate it. And get those documents to everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, next, Mr. Knutson. Come right on up, identify yourself, and take it away.
Chairman Huffman, committee members, for the record, my name is John Knutson. I own and operate Knutson Towboat Company in Coos Bay, and I have been a witness and or a testifier on this bill in committee prior to this, and from the fiscal standpoint, I don't see any. This is an unprecedented situation in Coos Bay, if I may speak to that. There's no other place in the United States where pilots own and operate ship assist tugboat companies. It creates a conflict of interest. That's why Mr. Soss from Soss Brothers Ocean Towing brought this bill to the legislature. This bill was passed out of committee unanimously to you folks, and I could answer any questions you may have about it. I can tell you that the pilot boat in Coos Bay is fully funded through pilot board hearings from back in 1993 at $500,000+ a year, and that we operate pilot boats in Aberdeen, Washington, and Eureka, California. Aberdeen costs the port $150,000 a year to fully fund a ex-Columbia River bar pilot boat, which they purchased from the Columbia River bar pilot some time ago, and we operate that. In Eureka, it's part of the ship assist package because the ship calls are so few. Fiscally, I don't see how this will affect Coos Bay pilots or the cost of doing business in Coos Bay other than to bring the cost down. Currently, ship assist rates in Coos Bay are twice as high as anywhere else up and down the west coast of the United States. $15,000 more than anywhere else on the coast.
I knew this was going to be a really tough discussion to have. You know, I try to stick with the fiscal. It's extremely tough because it is, so much of it is just policy based, and
sure.
And I know that the policy committee heard that. And I sorry to interrupt, John. I will open it up for questions. I do share the frustration that Mr. Fiscom said earlier about it being the way things are set up in this session. Senate bill is not going to go to a House committee to have what I would consider additional and proper vetting of something, but it comes straight down here, and we're given instructions to deal with the fiscal impacts of it, not the policy. So I do share that frustration. Senator Johnson?
Well, I would only add, though, Mr. Chair, that right now resting in Ways and Means is House Bill 4164, House Bill 4165, Senate Bill 1580, and Senate Bill 1581, where policy is actually being worked in Ways and Means. I think we're struggling to find our way in this first annual voter approved session, but it is not unprecedented in this short session that we're doing a lot of policy in Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Stark.
Just to reiterate, we just heard House Bill 4040. that came directly from the policy committee to this committee and will not be worked in a Senate policy committee. So it's going both ways.
Absolutely.
So and bills are coming this way from the House chamber and aren't getting worked in the. I mean, it's just a reality of the process we're in.
And I
whether we like it or not,
both ways. Thank you, Mr. Knutson. Appreciate you driving in and
thank you
taking the time to testify. I am going to. I know there are a lot of things going left unsaid, and I apologize for that. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1543A and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1591A relating to travel, and Ms. Jordan will be in shortly. And while we're waiting on this, Jordan, to come in and tee this up, I'm going to ask Mark Meyer, Mayor, from Legislative Council, if Mark could come up and I know we needed to get him out of the way on testimony, and so while we're waiting on Mark to come up, Susie Jordan has joined us. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1591 adds 13 rest areas to the current five being managed by the Travel Information Council. And you have a copy of the fiscal impact statement in your packet. And there are a few things that I would point out to you from that fiscal. ODOT costs to manage the 18 rest areas is $3 million per year. And TIC estimates their cost to manage the same rest areas at $7.5 million per year, which is $4.5 million more than the current ODOT cost to manage the rest areas. The measure also increases the transfer of $3 million per year to the Travel Information Council to $6.55 million per year, $1 million less than the amount the Travel Information Council estimates it will need to manage those rest areas. And while not part of the fiscal, but worthy of noting, I think, is the fact that there is no provision in the measure to adjust the payments to the Travel Information Council if total revenue declines or increases from the State Highway Fund. And there is no provision in the measure to adjust the payments to the Travel Information Council for inflation. And while there is an audit requirement, there is no provision in the measure to require the Travel Information Council to report the actual costs of managing and operating the rest areas. All of those are issues that I think are of a fiscal nature that should be reviewed and discussed by this committee.
Thank you. Mark, come right on up, sir.
Thanks.
Perfect timing. You are on deck. Identify yourself and go right ahead.
Chairpersons Verger and Huffman, I'm Mark Mayer from Legislative Council. Members of the committee, I was asked to come down here today to testify about how we handled the sunsetting of certain monies that were going to be allocated to the Travel Information Council up through the year 2020, as well as to address any other concerns you might have about the drafting of the amendments. So the Dash 7s and the Dash 8s, actually I did make some copies of Oregon Laws Chapter 865, Sections 56 through 60 for you guys, so you had easy reference to the laws, the provisions that we're dealing with here. I'm sure for some of you will bring back pleasant memories.
Thank you.
So the dash in Oregon Laws 2009, Chapter 865, we basically created the provision of law now codified at ORS 366752, which handles the allocations of monies attributed to certain fee increases and tax hikes related to transportation. I'm sure you're all familiar with that. Those monies are allocated currently according to the language set forth on the first page of this handout, which is Section 56, which became operative in January 1st, 2011. However, you'll see that there's one further amendment to that if you flip the page, which is on, looks like Section 60 specifies the operative date, January 2nd, 2020. amending out language that allocates $3 million to the Travel Information Council. So the proponents of the bill, the original requester, asked us to draft a bill that would eliminate those sunsettings of those allocations. And we did that in two different versions that now take the form before you in the Dash 7s and Dash 8s. The Dash 7s perpetuate the sunsetting of those allocations in their current form, whereas the Dash 8s, I understand, take the allocations straight from the state highway fund. And so they're very similar drafts. There's very few differences between the two amendments. It's just, where does the $3 million come from? That's the difference. The allocations are fairly straightforward until you get to the year 2013. If you look on page 8 of the Dash 8s, I believe it's the same page for the Dash 7s. They kind of fall in line. The very first section, Section 12, we repeal Section 60. And what that does is it delays the it repeals that delayed operative date. And the amendments to ORS 366752 that amend out that $3 million allocation will become effective on the operative date of Section 12. Section 14 makes that operative January 1st, 2013. So the difference is in the Dash 7s, we've amended that language back in to perpetuate it in its current form. You can see that in Section, I believe, 14. And in the Dash 8s, you'll see that all the monies from the State Highway Fund that are being allocated to the Travel Information Council from 2013 onward are always $3 million higher than those in the Dash 7s to account for the fact that we're not amending that $3 million allocation back into 366752. I know that's kind of confusing and a lot of operative dates and stuff going on, but are there any specific questions about what I've just covered?
Colleagues? Anything about the Dash 31s that is covered? Mark, I don't see anything. Yeah, anything to wrap up?
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Craig Campbell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell, and I would be remiss if I didn't join Director Garrett in wishing you a belated happy birthday, and for all of you, a happy Shrove Tuesday, Mardi Gras, happy National Sticky Bun Day, and my daughter's birthday. I wanted to start by thanking both Susan Jordan and Mike Mayer for doing the work that they've done on this bill. It has gone through several iterations since it was first put together and has gone through yet another before it has come to you. The changes effectively that we're bringing to you that is different from what it was in front of the policy committee was to address concerns predominantly raised by local governments about concerns about the source of funds not coming directly out of the operations and maintenance budget of the Department of Transportation, the Highway Fund. The source of the funds that are being used for this are the same that you discussed in the previous bill, Senate Bill 1543. The other thing that we did, and what Mark was trying to explain to you and understand, that does get very confusing. Essentially, when House Bill 2001 was passed back in 2009, the Job and Transportation Act, we took the $3 million to pay for rest areas off the top. What that meant is before the distribution between cities and counties. So cities and counties were effectively picking up half of that $3 million cost. What the Dash 8s do is it says, no, we're going to move that into the state portion of the highway fund so that it releases $1.3 million per year that will go to city and county road funds. The rest will be subsumed by the fee arrangement that you heard about earlier. So what the Dash 8s effectively do is they find a source other than operations and maintenance for the transfer of these rest areas, and it no longer takes a portion out of those funds that would otherwise have gone to cities and counties to pay for them. Also, there's a provision in the bill that requires the Secretary of State to do an audit provision of the expenditure of these funds, because one of the things we don't want to do, by the way, I should have identified that I'm Craig Campbell on behalf of the Oregon Travel Experience. Sorry about that. And Oregon Travel Experience is a semi-independent state agency. As we are going to be handling federal funds, federal highway funds, and want to make sure that we are doing that correctly, I'm sorry, state highway funds, we want to make sure we're not screwing up any federal laws, and so that our friends from the Department of Transportation end up getting angst about whether or not they're going to get any federal funds. So at their suggestion, we've asked the Secretary of State's department to do an audit of our use of these funds as we use them in the rest area. And the last comment I will make, if you have not yet had an opportunity to come out and see some of the rest areas we manage, we would very much open an invitation to you to do so. We're doing some pretty fantastic work, and we're very proud of what we're doing.
Okay, so Craig, the ask is still for $7.5 million. The total dollars remains the same, but the pots of money from where it comes from is the main part that's changed. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, when finally implemented, the total amount of money we're asking for is $6.55 million per year. That's after full implementation, which would begin January 1st, 2014. We ramp up taking two additional rest areas between now and the end of this year. Then we add the rest areas on I-84 between 2013 and 2014. And then beginning 2014, we take on a series of additional rest areas on I-5.
Questions? Senator Berger?
Yes, I would like for you to respond to Ms. Jordan's discussion about the gaps here, that it doesn't say if you don't have enough money, you don't make enough money, or if you make more than you think that you were going to make. Those are pretty significant things, certainly for the trust fund.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, actually, I'm glad you asked the question because there's some work that will need to be done in the future. What we're looking at here is funds that are going to be used for rest areas that have in some instances, quite a bit of deferred maintenance. So the cost you see up front is probably going to be higher than what we need in the long run. It is up to us to do two things beyond this point in this bill. One is when our cost needs go down, we need to come back to you and return the money that we don't need back to the Department of Transportation through the Highway Fund. The second thing we need to do is ultimately our goal is to try and wean rest areas from highway fund expenditure at all. Currently, we have some challenges with the way federal law is written and the way we can use revenues that we would otherwise maybe generate in rest areas. We can't do that now. However, we're going to be working with our federal partners to achieve that. In the meantime, we're also going to work in future sessions when we're dealing with revenue-generating packages for the highway fund, making sure that we raise them enough to cover the cost that this particular transfer of rest areas deals with. One of the issues that will be, we're looking at this bill as a short-term financial fix, including the source of the funds. We will need to come back to you with a long-term fix and one that is more flexible. One of our challenges now is dealing with the rest areas that we're dealing with now. Once we take them over, we find a whole variety of issues that we need to take on, so we don't know with certainty how much it's going to cost us to do that. Of course, we're taking a risk in that there's no inflationary factor in here either, so that if our costs go up, we would have to come back to you anyway. But it is my commitment that OTE, if we have too much money, we don't need it, we will come back to you to provide it back to the Highway Fund so that the Department of Transportation can use it for the good work that they do with those funds.
Follow-up? Are you good?
It's okay.
Anything else from anybody? You complete, sir?
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Senator Thompson, did you want to weigh in on your appreciation of rest areas or anything, or just are you just back there soaking this up?
Well, I just came to watch it, and I'm afraid if I say something, I'll just get in trouble with Senator Courtney again. So I
understood and appreciated.
Probably Senator smart that he stays in the back of the room.
Oh, glad that got on the record. Craig Honeyman, come on up, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Craig Honeyman, Legislative Director of the League of Oregon Cities. Let me offer my happy birthday wishes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Day late. As we stated in the policy committee, the League of Oregon Cities certainly understands and appreciates the need for excellent rest areas for the safety and enjoyment of the automobile and truck drivers on our highways. So I'm here having reviewed the A8 amendments in support of the proposal that is contained therein. Originally, the way the bill was introduced, we had serious concerns about the possibility that the increase in funding for roadside rest areas was going to be another off-the-top exercise. Subsequent amendments suggested that the funding come from the maintenance budget of ODOT. That raised in the minds of cities secondary concerns. So this amendment, I guess I would characterize third time as the charm. This is an excellent concept that has been proposed in that it removes the original stipulation that the original $3 million is off the top, accruing then to the state and to cities and counties some additional funds at a time when, speaking for cities, city road budgets are significantly upside down on an annual basis, as I testified to the policy committee. And frankly, the revenues derived from the Jobs and Transportation Act, I understand, are underperforming by a little bit. So every dollar will help, and we believe that these amendments will help do that. So with that, again, let me reiterate our support for the Dash A8 amendments and express my appreciation to representatives of the OTE, the Oregon Tribal Youth Experience, for listening to and understanding our concerns and addressing them in these amendments. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Thank you, Craig. Anything for Craig?
Senator Mr. Chairman, I just want to make the comment while Greg is here that at the state level, we need to be very cognizant of being sure that you're taken care of well. We're looking at the county situation right now, and it's very serious and very serious for the state. And so in every way that we need to help you protect your shared revenues so that you will stay solvent, and will not be coming to the city saying, I no longer can take care of these, coming to the state saying, I no longer can take care of these services. So you know that I am a strong local government person anyway, but even if I weren't in this situation, I think this has to open eyes to what could happen if local governments are not treated fairly.
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Berger, thank you for those comments.
Thank you. Thanks, Craig. And while Ann Hannis is coming up, I want to take the opportunity to thank ODOT and OTE and Senator Thompson, Representative Johnson, and I had a hearing up in Town Hall, maybe is more appropriate, in Welch's on the government camp rest area, and I appreciate everybody coming together to keep that rest area open. It really built an awareness with me and my constituents the importance of rest areas. It's not something you talk about, or they don't email you and say, hey, what about, until something happens. And boy, I'll tell you, rest areas were certainly elevated in my mind, that the constituents in Central Oregon in particular were very vocal about they expect that to be a part of the package that they pay taxes for, by golly, period. So I'll shut up. Ann,
thank
welcome.
You. Chair Huffman, for the record, I'm Ann Hannis with the Association of Oregon Counties, and counties would also like to wish you a belated happy birthday.
Thank you. There's no gifts here, though. It's just this
big up.
We, like the League of Oregon Cities, had voiced concerns about the source of the funding and the potential impact to counties, particularly if it had been taken off the top or there had been programs that ODOT would have to cut back that would impact us. So we're very appreciative that the proponents of this bill have worked with us and listened to us about those concerns. As a result, and because this new source of revenue has been identified to fund rest areas and the two projects and take it, and so that it's not funded off the top, we're now supportive of the Dash 8 amendments and this bill. It deals with our issues about not taking it off the top and not impacting ODOT's existing operations and maintenance budget, and it also funds a couple needed projects like the Selwood Bridge and Cornelius Pass. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Anything for Ann? Seeing nothing. Thank you, Ann. Appreciate it. Director Garrett. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I will stay specific to the fiscal realities associated with this. We'll harken back to the Jobs and Transportation Act. There's no question that we grew the pie, and we created an opportunity where there was a joint venture that bloomed with the Oregon Department of Transportation and the Travel Information Council to enhance the experience of the rest areas. Yeah. Now, over time, and as we've heard today, there's been a pivot of how that will be funded. So I go in with the hope that that funding is realized and is as robust as we see. I acknowledge the potential threat to that and how we will handle that in the future should that be the case. In light of the fact that I've been before this subcommittee, and you'll recall I spoke to the fiscal realities that my department faces in terms of the decline in state trust fund dollars, the implications to the condition, the overall maintenance and preservation of the system, specifically the bridges, the pavements. We've got facility needs, whether they're on the highway side, or the driver and motor vehicle sides. So as we continue to move forward, whatever pathway we end up taking here, my hope is the partnership will continue to grow in terms of our ability to engage other public and private conversations. There's a model from the Commonwealth of Virginia, where they're extremely robust in the way they invest. It is a public-private partnership. I'm not talking about commercialization of rest areas, but really truly enhancing an opportunity where there are public-private opportunities there. And again, if need be, how do we address a situation where there needs to be offsets to this type of investment because the monies are not realized? Again, this is moving into the state trust fund. There's no question about it. But there is a trade-off. There is more money being taken out than we paid for it. So where's the trade-off on that? Those are the decisions that we will work. Again, I hope that the e-portal conversation is healthy and moves forward. But I think it's prudent to be on the balls of our feet to address potential threats to that funding source and then the implications to the maintenance of the transportation system. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll stand down.
Comments? Representative Bree.
A question, Mr. Chair. Mr. Director, I think I picked up some of the answer in what you said, but imagine this bill didn't go forward, it wasn't proposed, and the e-portal, the rest of the conversation went forward as has been described. Could you talk a bit more about what the priorities would be and where that money might go? In essence, we're being asked to, I think, to direct that money to rest areas, and I want to have a better understanding of where it would go if that request was not being made.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, I think you could have a fairly robust conversation as to where the monies could go. Again, all the projects that have been identified are more than appropriate for this type of expenditure. But again, if we were having this conversation elsewhere, we could put a lot of other issues on the table that have proven themselves to be potential deficits or exposures specific to the transportation system. And that's the way I would look at it, as a transportation system. So again, we could talk about the challenges we face on the highway side. I spoke to that a little bit earlier. We could talk about some of the needs specific to the DMV. Again, there is some language that will move in the direction, I think, to do appropriate pick-and-shovel work on modernizing a computer system that truly is in the rotary age. We're having pretty heady conversation in terms of a transition from a gas tax to some type of road user fee. Right now, the mechanics with regard to the driver, to DMV and their computer system, they don't sync up. We may be compromising something that we are pioneering here in the state of Oregon because we don't have the appropriate architecture in terms of computing systems. So you can look at that. I think the challenges of the cities and counties, again, you look specifically to the counties, you've got some of those folks that are very close to going paws up here. There are implications to the transportation systems with our county brethren. And as Mr. Honeyman broached, the issues and the challenges that face the cities as well. Might there be a safety net? You could have all these conversations, so it would be a very healthy, robust discussion here. I think where we've landed in terms of the discussion, more than appropriate to send it there. And again, I think the timelines associated with this legislative session really haven't allowed us to have that robust of conversation, because it would take a while, I'll be very honest with you, because there's a lot of needs that are playing themselves out. It's a very long answer, probably not as specific as you wanted, but I think that's really, as you step back and look at this conversation and all the needs we have in the transportation world, this would be a very healthy conversation that would bring many people around the table to inform it.
Thank you. Director Garrett, without bringing Dugan back up, maybe you can answer, just to refresh my memory, was the roughly $8 million, was that annual or biennial?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it's about $7.9 million on an annual
basis.
From that, okay. $4.68.
And I noticed Senator Starr had done a great job prior to the committee spending pretty much all of that. Any questions of the director? I appreciate the committee hanging around. We have gone over by quite a little bit here. Senator Berger. Yes.
I just want to say something to Director Garrett, because this is our first annual. And unless something is changed that takes the differential here with the months, in other words, we now have 5 and 1 in the annual sessions, and unless we move to 4 and 2, you're going to be faced with this 29-30-day session a lot, and that's going to be very different, I think. Your comment about if we were in a longer session, more things could be vetted. And so I think your agency and other agencies are going to have to make an adjustment in realizing that some of the work that is being done perhaps in sessions is going to have to be done in the interim. In preparing legislators, because I can foresee just from being in this session, and while I won't be in the next one, I can foresee, if it doesn't change, that this expediting is not going to be any different. And so I appreciate your comment, but I think it is serious consideration for you as to what is to be heard in these sessions of 29 days.
Mr. Chairman, very quickly, Senator, I think you're spot on in terms of the opportunities that we have to work these issues during the interim. I think that's where the relationship between the state agencies and our various boards and legislative panels, we can do a lot of work to prep to make this type of conversation a much better informed conversation with all the nuance and wrinkles, both in the short term and long term, understood and then ironed out. It would make for a much better conversation. I completely embrace and subscribe to the notion that the work needs to be done during the interim to prep for these things.
Thank you, Director.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, hearing nothing else, I am going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1591. And if there's nothing else for the good of the order, thank you. I hope I did okay carrying the gavel today. It was a difficult meeting, keeping everything confined, but maybe there will be a lunch party outside the door waiting for me. We are adjourned. Thank you.